37 in Racine, 30 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This past weekend, my wife Kathy and I were privileged to be in the audience for one of the performances of Trevor the Musical in the Black Box Theater at Bradford High School as part of Kenosha Unified's musical theater program. We have a niece who was in the cast, and two of my private voice students were in the cast as well. So we knew from them something about this production, but we were not prepared for just how powerful and poignant it would be. Trevor the Musical is based on an Oscar-winning short film made back in 1995, which tells the story of a young adolescent male named Trevor who is struggling to fit in and struggling to understand who he is and struggling with his own sexual orientation. At one point, he becomes so painfully ostracized from nearly all of his schoolmates that he attempts suicide. The creators of this film were concerned when the film was shown that a young person in a similar situation watching the film might be triggered in some way. And when they discovered that there was no national hotline for suicide prevention for LGBTQ young people, they created one themselves. They called it the Trevor Project, and it is in existence to this very day. A few years later, this film, this story, was transformed into Trevor the Musical, with a libretto by Dan Collins and musical score by Julianne Wick Davis. My morning show guest, Holly Stanfield, who coordinates the musical theater program for Kenosha Unified, directed this production, and I had the pleasure of recording an interview with her Monday morning, talking about the experience, what it was like for her and the students who comprise the cast and crew of this production.
So the story of Trevor in the show is about a middle school child. The original story that was created off Broadway was about the middle school culture. And Trevor's a young man who really quite honestly is just a young teen. And he begins the story just very innocently being a kid that doesn't quite know where he fits in. And he's looking for his friends like most of us do in middle school. And as the story progresses, you see that he's reaching out to all different sorts of kids. He reaches out to kids that are probably a little more academically minded. He reaches out to the kids that are more sports-minded, and in the shape of the story, eventually the kids accuse him of being a gay student, which actually at this point in the story confuses Trevor. He's not thinking about himself as anything yet, and he's put in that place in the student culture, and eventually he has a hard time reaching out to his parents, and his parents have an idea that something's going on with him. And they really don't know how to talk to him about it. They try. You see them try several times in the show to speak with him, and they just can't bring themselves to say it. The show is definitely set in the 80s, which is a different time than when we live now. And I believe setting the show at that time in our history probably makes it watchable for everyone. I think it's brilliantly written. And so eventually Trevor attempts to take his life, does not succeed, and has to find himself working his way back into that middle school culture. And eventually, by the end of the show, he begins to stand up for himself and who he really is, and embrace his gifts. Hmm. So that's the story of Trevor the Musical. Our production was a pilot for Music Theater International to bring the story of Trevor into the high school culture. So our production was not focused on middle school culture. It was focused on high school culture.
So was the show in any way rewritten, or did you simply place it in a different setting and otherwise essentially leave it alone?
They did not rewrite any of the script, per se. What they did have to do is rewrite the keys for the show, because the original Trevor off-Broadway was an unchanged male voice. So the keys had to be rewritten so that we could have a young baritone time sing the show. Yeah.
So the music had to be reshaped a bit in order for older singers to be able to successfully sing it then.
Yes. So that is what, the composer, Julianne, came yesterday afternoon and was incredibly impressed with the work that the students had done with it, and very pleased about how things are progressing with a version that can be licensed by high school people.
And you were essentially the pilot production for this version, which one presumes will at some point be taken up by other high school musical theater programs, presumably across the country.
Yes. That's exactly right. We were the first production of that.
Exciting. Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Holly Stanfield, and we are talking about a production of the Kenosha Unified School District that just finished up of Trevor the Musical, books and lyrics by Dan Collins, music by Julianne Wick Davis, and as Holly Stanfield was just explaining, this production was a pilot for a new version of this off-Broadway musical, reconceiving it as being set in high school. And it's a very intriguing work. My understanding is all of this actually began with an Oscar-winning short film called Trevor that essentially told the story. And at some point, that story without music was then ultimately transformed into a musical. Holly, I'm just curious. I mean, obviously, part of what you do is coordinating musical theater for Kenosha Unified is you have to have your ear to the ground and are always on the lookout for the next great show. Do you recall exactly how you became acquainted with Trevor the Musical? And is this a show that you were able to experience in person directly before deciding that it should be presented in Kenosha?
Actually, this is, pardon me, this is a show that I was not familiar with. Oftentimes we have a long-lasting relationship with Music Theater International to pilot productions that are moving from the professional realm into the high school realm. And my contact and friend at Music Theater International, John Prignano, called me. Believe it or not, I was on vacation in Maine. And the phone rang, and I said, "Hey, John, what's up?" He said, "You know, I know you're already doing a pilot of Mean Girls, High School Edition, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for us, but I really, really, really want you to do this story." And I said, "Okay, I'll take a look at it." And he recommended that I watch it. It is actually, there is a wonderful video of the off-Broadway New World Stages production on Disney Plus. So that was my first exposure to the musical and to the story. Quite honestly, I did not know what the Trevor Project was. So it's been a wonderful awakening for me. And after seeing the piece on Disney Plus and talking, obviously, when we do things at my school, it's not just me. Talking to my compatriots, Jody Williams, our technical director, and Christy Geidner, who also does both technical theater and directing at Bradford, we decided that it was a really great story for the students who are in our culture right now that we are working with.
So talk a bit about what it was like for the students who were part of this production. And this is something I already know a little bit about, just having spoken with several of the cast members who I know personally. But I'm so anxious to hear it from you, and I want our listeners to hear about just what kind of an experience it was for them to take on a story like this, and in particular, a story, in a sense, so close to home, in the sense that this is set in the setting and culture of a high school, and probably hit very close to home, I should think.
It did. I think that a lot of the students, when the cast list went up for our season, went on to Disney Plus and watched it. And I think that they liked it. That's where they were with it. So we were pleased that they all wanted to participate in the project to start. So we began the process, like we usually do, with a read-through of the script. So we sat in a circle, and we read the script, and we listened to the songs. And quite honestly, at the end of that read-through, many of them were in tears. And I was, I can't say the word as surprised. I enjoyed the musical, the off-Broadway production, and it was beautifully directed and beautifully acted. But to hear high school voices do it and to be in the same room with the words instead of watching it on video, it was incredible. I'm not sure there's words to describe that moment. It was everything I think that the script wants it to be. It became for those students. It was a place where they knew many of their classmates were, and as LGBTQ children, not all, everyone in the cast, but certainly we have some representatives from that community in the cast, and allies of LGBTQ students, I think it was incredibly resonant for them. One student said, "I wish that I had been able to see this story when I was a middle school child. I think it's an important story for people to hear." So that kind of began our journey with the show, and it was an incredible moment for them and for me.
I wonder what it's like in a show like this, where someone is cast in a particular role, like the title role of Trevor, for instance, or somebody is cast in one of the roles in which it's a young person who, in a sense, acts as a villain or whom the audience sees in a very negative light because of the terrible things that they might say about Trevor or the way they treat Trevor and so on. What is it like to give a role like that to a young person? What's it like for a young person to be cast in a role like that? And I think in certain shows that probably isn't that big an issue. It's not quite the same thing being the villain in Oklahoma versus being one of the villains in a show like this. Can you talk about that?
You have to be very careful when you cast students in roles always, because you want them to be safe. So when you do that, you open the conversation and say, if there's anything that you don't feel that you can say, just don't say it. And that's where you begin. With this cast, they were willing, I think, after the first read-through, to say the words. I think they understood the weight of the words, but after most moments in the show where there is some weight to the conversation that the kids are having, the characters are having, we would always make sure that people felt like they could talk it back if they needed to, and always checking in with them to make sure that they were okay with what they were saying. I think the script is well written enough so that there are moments where you see that. But a good portion of the script is just spent in watching kids be kids. Mm. And there is a lot of comedy. I think good writing, when you work with it and when you see it, allows you to become part of the story, and oftentimes comedy is used to make that safe. Mm. And then we go to the places where we need to go, and then the script winds again out of those moments into the culture, and again you're seeing who we are in a positive sense. And there's not a character in the show that is written to be really the bad guy. They are written to be characters. We all have flaws. Every character is flawed in its own way. And that's to be human. And I think it's a very human telling of a very important story. Hmm. And I think the kids did feel safe within the words of the script, because it didn't turn any of the characters into the bad guys. Particularly.
Right. I appreciated, among other things, the fact that, as you said, the first act of the musical is, at least for the most part, very light in tone, and a lot of it is hilariously funny, especially mm-hmm. The title character of Trevor and his interaction with certain classmates is really, really funny. And the fact that the show then can go from there to a much darker, much more painful place, and can feel like the same journey, I think is an impressive accomplishment, because I think a lot of times when a show drastically changes in tone, it feels like two different shows, maybe even uh-huh. by two different composers or writers. And this didn't feel like that at all to me. It's probably a testament not only to the show originally as written, but also to what you and your cast were able to do with it.
I'm going to kind of put the praise of accomplishment on the students. The students really did embrace this, and much of that work was theirs. I mean, I'm just there as a director, and you're such a wonderful director, so you understand that you always just have to work through your students and let them create and just find the moments that work in their rhythms. So really, that's their work. And it's really amazing when you start to work with gifted young people to watch basically them begin to be courageous and find the ways to make a story like this work. And they really did exceptional work. I'm very proud of what they are and who they are. It takes a lot of courage to tell a story like this, especially in front of your parents.
Absolutely,
that's a big moment for young people.
We're speaking with Holly Stanfield about the production of Trevor the Musical that just closed. It ran for a single weekend of performances at Bradford High School in their Black Box Theater. One of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you about was the choice to place this in that tiny Black Box Theater. Versus on the big stage where most musicals for Kenosha Unified are seen. And of course, there were probably a number of different reasons why that choice was made, but nevertheless, it was a choice. And I wonder if you can just kind of talk about what you think the benefits were, but also what some of the challenges were in terms of making this happen within that small Black Box Theater.
Well, again, when John Frigano called in August and said, hey, I really would love to have you tell the story, and I looked at it and knew that it would be extremely resonant for my students. We had already placed several productions in the year around it, and our students also work with other directors in town, so they had made plans to create productions also in our season. So this seemed to be the only moment in the year where we could accomplish this. So quite honestly, the students that were in this production worked just for 50 minutes during the day and then on several weekends to put this together. It was put together rather quickly. So just the logistics of doing it in our season put it in the Black Box. But that being said, New World Stages, actually I have directed on New World Stages in New York when I have worked for iTheatrics, putting up staged readings of works for the Junior Theater Collection. They are very small spaces, and you don't see that when you look at the video of Trevor off-Broadway, but that's a very intimate space, and this is an incredibly intimate story. So, honestly, our season probably created the best environment for the story to be told in. And years ago, I went to an incredible production of Sunday in the Park with George at Chicago Shakespeare Theater in their small space, and it was done in this bowling alley style. And I just was very engaged with how the audience interacts with the action on the stage during that production. So I've done this style two or three times during my history at Bradford High School, and I really felt that with this story especially, it would be best if we set up the studio so that it felt like the audience was in the story with the students. So we put desks into the audience and lit them so that actually the audience was watching students sitting next to them, acting and telling the story, and drawing them into the fact that we all have been to high school, and yes, many of us are very distant from that point in our lives, but we certainly remember moments and feelings and how that did shape the adults that we have become. So everybody in that room has had that experience, and if there were younger students there, that's an experience that they are already a part of. We did not have a lot of young students because of the way that the story, I would say the youngest person that probably saw it was a middle school child, and it's aimed at their culture, so they certainly understand it. So I think that was the beauty of putting it into the studio, was bringing it into a very intimate space and having people feel very strongly what was right next to them. When a character cries, you're not further than 10 feet, 11, 12 feet away from them. And that's a different experience than seeing something in a large proscenium venue.
Hmm. And of course, it's different for the performers, too.
Oh, yeah. It takes a lot of courage to continue to stay in your character and to be vulnerable when an audience member is sitting 4 feet from you. It's also a very powerful feeling when you have the courage to submerge yourself in a character. And I don't know about you as a young person, as a performer, but for some reason that was always a very safe place for me. If I could take on another character, not being me particularly, saying Holly Stanfield is not the character that's written, but Holly Stanfield is playing a character that's written, I could go places that I could never go socially, ever. And I don't know how, I guess I never asked the kids how they feel about that in their lives, but in my life, it was a very safe place to be, which probably is why I'm a theater artist and teacher. But there's also, you begin to feel the audience coming with you. And when you're telling a story and you know the story that you're telling and you're into feeling that story in that moment and you feel your audience begin to feel it with you, it is a type of communication that is visceral and something, quite honestly, that I don't think you ever forget in your life. And I'm sure you must have moments in your performing life where you remember those feelings. I remember my senior musical, and this was not an intimate thing, was Hello, Dolly. And I was playing Mrs. Malloy. And I was not my dad was a teacher. My mom didn't work until later in life, so we didn't have a lot of money in our family. So I had maybe a very few record albums when I was a kid. But I would always get the album of the show that we were going to do because that was really important. And I remember spending my senior year listening to the finale of my last musical in high school, Hello, Dolly, and I would always cry. So anytime I go to see Hello, Dolly, whether it's a professional production or a high school production, I always cry during the finale because it's so far in my body that I cannot control it. Because you've been a part of that moment in that piece of art, and your whole being is involved in that. And I do believe that every time these students hear some of the moments in this show, they will not be able to control that part of their emotions because they have felt it that deeply. The young woman who came from off-Broadway said that when she was doing it, it was different because you're in the story and you're telling the story and you're the character, so you can't cry during those moments because you're not that part, you're not that character in the show. But now when she comes and watches any production of it, it really takes her part because she's so submerged in the story and what's going on. So that's the beauty of those small spaces especially. The challenges is probably sound. The black box is a very live space, and usually when we put microphones on kids, we have some control over the soloist having more technical support with the microphone and the ensemble and the balance of the musical instruments. And in that space, it's really all just organic sound, and the students really had to sing when they were singing oohs and ahs, accompanying some of the solo moments. And the pianist really had to be careful about levels and diction. And so there are a lot of challenges that are presented when you're doing something in that style as well.
Well, it really worked well, and again, to experience that story up close and personal within that intimate space made it all the more powerful. When you spoke to the audience before the performance began, one of the things you said was that this year in the musical theater program feels like finally stepping back towards something at least resembling normal after the difficult period of the COVID-19 pandemic, and you said something to the effect that actually last year in some ways was even harder than that previous year when things were all but shut down, and such painful experiences for so many people in the performing arts, but that last year was, even as you were inching back towards performing, was very difficult in its own way, and that this year by contrast just felt like the students have stepped into kind of a different place. Can you just summarize what you were getting at there in terms of where your students kind of find themselves now compared to, for instance, a year ago?
You know, you watch CNN or you watch NBC or Fox News or whoever you watch, and they would say, or NPR, they would say that children are going to have arrested social development, that, you know, we're very concerned about this, and you hear doctors talking, and you hear it academically. But if you're the people that are meeting children on a daily basis, we definitely experience that. When people, I'm not even going to say children, I'm just going to say people. When people are isolated like we were, which for our health was totally necessary. When you step back out of that very small space that you have put yourself in to, it takes courage. And especially with young people who are in such a developmental stage in their lives where they're questioning everything, and chemically their bodies are going through so many changes, and to not be able to be in a larger culture to grow and to experience how to relate to one another really, really changed for many of them. And as we came back online, basically, or offline, I guess that's a better way to say it, into a public setting last year, it was breathtaking, I think, for all of the adults involved to watch young people begin to find themselves with other people again. And when you're teaching a subject where you have to open to one another, it was a different path. It was a different reality coming back to that. And we really watched a lot of our students struggle with that in a very visceral way, and needed to be involved with creating a safe space where they could speak with us about how that felt, and where their parents could speak with us about how that felt, and try to facilitate a place where they began to, you know, feel the new normal. And that happened, actually. It was interesting to watch that journey, and also, I think, very stressful for all of us. And as we came out of last year, I think that the kids decided that they were beginning to feel a little more comfortable with everything, and it just feels this year like we are, it's not the same normal. I don't think we will ever go back to the normal that it was prior to the pandemic. We are in a new place, but we are definitely finding a path to a new feeling of safety in the environment that they're working in school. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the best words for it.
And that makes all the difference when it comes to the business that you're in, and particularly with something like Trevor the Musical. And I think all of what you just described contributed to making it such a powerful and poignant experience for all of us. So I'm sorry for our listeners who did not have the opportunity to see this. Is there any possibility that there will be other performances in the future?
I am not sure. We are loosely discussing, and it may or may not happen. The International Thespian Festival is something that we have attended a lot, and we have done a lot of main stage productions there. Now we can only do something every other year there, so we did Groundhog Day the Musical last summer on the main stage, so we cannot take something to that venue this year. And actually, this show is way too intimate, I think, for that very large space. But with Music City International, right now we are talking about perhaps doing a workshop, informants kind of a thing. So if pieces of this will be going to the festival, then at least portions we might perform again in Kenosha. And we'll see if that happens. That would be really great. The thing that I've found with the show is when someone says, hey, what are you doing with your day? And I say, hey, we're doing Trevor the Musical, and they ask what it is. It opens a conversation about not the musical per se, but also about the Trevor Project, which again is a national site that lends support to LGBTQ students who are in a bad place. And that's a great conversation to have. And it's quite interesting that every day after the show, someone stopped me and said, I'm so glad you're doing this. This is what's going on in my life. And for people to feel safe enough to say those things, we had people in our talkback sessions, you know, say, hey, this is where my family was, and this is where I am. We had families that are a part of the show say, hey, this is what's going on with us. And again, theater and arts are the best when we are allowing for conversations that help our communities become safe for everybody. And I think that the show is definitely doing that for people, and it's important.
Absolutely. Holly Stanfield, director of Kenosha Unified's production of Trevor the Musical, thank you so much. Congrats on this terrific accomplishment, and very best wishes with everything that will follow thereafter as you finish up yet another school year. And thanks for being part of the morning show today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out today's program, I'm going to the Morning Show archives for a memorable conversation from 2013 with best-selling author Tim Fetterly, talking about his debut novel intended for young readers called Better Nate Than Ever, published by Simon & Schuster. The book tells the story of a 13-year-old boy named Nate who is head over heels in love with music theater and dreams of starring on Broadway. Interestingly, Tim Fetterly himself performed on Broadway as a young person is a part of the original casts for both The Little Mermaid and for the 2003 revival of Gypsy that starred Bernadette Peters. So this young protagonist in the story, Nate, I have a feeling is to some extent a reflection maybe of who you were in high school. Tell us about the parallels, and maybe if there are any differences, point those out to us as well, between Nate and Tim Federle.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nate's a 13-year-old boy, but I do think to some extent every grown-up guy is a little bit of a teenager forever. So there are aspects that we certainly share. Nate is kind of obsessed with theater, and he gets a bit teased for it in his school, which is in a sort of fictional small rural hometown in Pennsylvania. I would say the biggest differences between me and Nate are that I have parents who are very... Parents who, by the way, met and went to college at Marquette.
Ah, really?
And they met in their college choir. So even though neither one of my parents went into the arts, they were always very supportive of my older brother and me and our pursuits of the arts, especially mine. So, you know, I do share some qualities with Nate Foster and Better Nate Than Ever, but a lot of it is it's fictionalized just because I didn't want my parents to sue me.
Right. It's an interesting story, and it's a story that certainly has some pain. But one of the things that I think I appreciated about the book, and I think a lot of young readers would appreciate this too, is that in a sense, it seems to me anyway, you managed to share with us the rather harsh reality of being picked on or bullied a bit, but not in sort of its full awfulness. I mean, this Nate is not bullied to the sort of brutal extent that we sometimes hear about and that can lead to tragic results. It's not quite that scenario. And for instance, his parents, they have some problems as parents, but they're not awful parents. And he has an older brother who's a really good athlete, but he's not an awful older brother. I mean,
right.
In some ways, I don't feel like you're shying away from life's harshest reality so much as serving up a story that feels more real because it isn't quite so garish in terms of what's bad about Nate's life.
Yeah, Greg, you're picking up on things that I was really hoping to incorporate when I wrote the book, which is to say a lot of Nate's life, like a lot of our lives in real life, has a sort of like low-grade fever quality. It's kind of uncomfortable. It's not perfect. The kids at school don't totally get him. But I wanted to write something kind of aspirational where maybe kids and adult readers, like you mentioned, could say, oh, yeah, that, you know, sometimes life stinks and there are moments in every day, whether it's going to the gym or getting looked at for maybe dressing a little bit differently or saying something that's a little bit strange in your community, but that there might be a place for you out there where you really belong. And so I wanted to incorporate some of those kind of bullying elements because it's what I grew up with, but it wasn't what defined my life. And I think so often the stories that we tell to kids are either very, very dark or they're kind of full of half-truths and, you know, rainbows and lollipops. And I wanted to do something that sort of struck something, for me at least, a little more realistic.
I think you've really achieved that, and I think you just now said it very, very well. One of the abiding themes is of Nate's anxiousness to get out of this little town of, is it Junkburg? Is that the name?
Jankburg.
Jankburg, Pennsylvania. And you say at one point he's thinking to himself what he thinks the motto of the town should be. It should be emblazoned on a sign. 48.5 miles from Pittsburgh and 1,000 miles from fun. I mean, this is a little town that he just finds sort of, in a sense, hopelessly oppressive and just not a town and populated with people that just don't understand him.
Well, that's, you know, at time, I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, and it's funny, I now look at it with so much sort of warmth, and it's taken on the patina of, you know, there's some sentimentality now on my part, because I moved to New York City myself when I was a teenager to kind of chase my Broadway dreams. And now 14 or so years later, there are times when it's like, oh my gosh, if I hear one more cab honking in the middle of the night. And so there are times when I go, ah, if only the glory days of living in Pittsburgh, where it was so quiet in the suburbs. And I think even Nate, who experiences some hardships in Jankberg, PA, when he gets to New York and experiences some of the discomforts of such a fast, frenetic city, even little Nate, who dreams of performing on Broadway, realizes there are some assets to his hometown.
Right. Although I also think you do a fantastic job of helping us understand how a youngster like Nate would look at an amazing city like New York City. Imagine pretzels sold on the street. It's as if anything is possible.
Well, I remember that's how it felt when I was 14 and my mom took me to New York for the first time as a big, you know, gift for, you know, not getting a C on my report card. My parents, we worked in opposite fashion because I struggled in school. It's like if I didn't get a D, I got a dollar. And she took me to New York, and I'll never forget. It's like when you give a little kid, you know, this big fancy toy, and they end up playing with the box. And we landed in New York, and I remember looking outside the hotel window at this sea of yellow taxi cabs, and I just stared at it, mesmerized for 15 minutes. And she's thinking, we came all the way to New York City for Tim to, like, look at a bunch of cabs. but you know, that's what you're picking up on, Greg, in part is that I wanted to fall back in love with New York, which can be full of edges and, you know, loud noises. And I, when I was working on Billy Elliot, where I trained the young child stars on Broadway, I became enamored of the way they were just so taken with New York, and it was so fun to them. And I decided, you know, this might be a good place to write, you know, a novel about a kid who crashes an audition for E.T. the musical. And that's what I wanted to do with Better Nate Than Ever.
One of the things that makes this adventure possible is that he has a co-conspirator who doesn't go along with him, but helps in the planning of this and helps sort of mask the fact that that Nate is gone. And this is his good friend, Libby, who harbors many of the same interests, and so they are these two quirky, offbeat personalities who mesh so beautifully together, and it really makes a difference in terms of Nate being able to pursue this dream. Tell our listeners what these two do when they want to curse. This is so funny.
Well, it is a book for middle graders, and so I wanted to get, you know, the book is aimed squarely at kids sort of 9 to 14 years old, though I've been lucky enough to hear from a lot of adult readers who get a kick out of it. And so I wanted to be appropriate with the way these kids would swear. So what they do is they shout out legendary titles from flop Broadway musicals. So, you know, something terrible happens. He misses the bus to New York or something, and he goes, you know, moose murders it all to tarnation.
Right.
Moose murders is like the most legendary Broadway flop of all time.
Right. Or Holy Dance of the Vampires. Or, I mean, if it was movies, it would be like Holy Ishtar. That would be a way to swear the way that I love that. One of the things which drives this dream for Nate is that he lives to some extent in the shadow of an older brother who is a wonderful athlete, especially in track. And at one point you have Anthony thinking to himself in the midst of this journey, everything is riding on me making this happen. I have to return home as good as Anthony is at something, anything, or not return home at all, preferably. Tell us just a little bit more about how you painted this relationship between Nate and his older brother, Anthony. Again, I think you do it in very realistic yet interesting fashion.
Thank you so much, Greg. I grew up in the shadow, a long shadow, of a very brilliant older brother who went on and had this Ivy League education, and he was 3 years older than me. And I think for a lot of kids who have an older sibling, every time you get to math class, on the first day of school, the teacher says, oh my gosh, I had Andy Federley and he was so brilliant. And it's like, oh great, the pressure's on. And when you're a kid, you're already worried about, you know, the new zit that just formed on your nose and the fact that maybe, oh gosh, I don't have the coolest new pair of shoes. So to add on top of that, the legacy of a brilliant older sibling can be quite heavy. Now, Andy and I have gotten quite close as adults, but I wanted to dramatize that feeling that I think a lot of kids have when they're trying to carve out their own voice, but feel the sort of heaviness of whether it's an older sibling or parents who expect something of them. And for Nate, in Better Nate Than Ever, he really is this. He is the definition of a black sheep, or maybe a pink sheep, and he just doesn't fit into his family. And so I wanted that older brother there to really illustrate within, you know, three pages of chapter one, that even though our families may love us, they don't always understand us. And right. That's what's amazing about, you know, the arts. I know that you're also into, you have a big music background, Greg, and anybody who's into the arts knows that you can make up your own family of, you know, misfit toys when you get into music or theater.
it's absolutely true. And we haven't actually talked very much about the show for which he's auditioning, a musical version of E.T., or the fact that you do an incredible job of describing what we presume to be something that at least somewhat resembles what it's like to show up for an open audition where you find yourself lost in a sea of hundreds of young, hopeful faces, many much better prepared than Nate is. And yet, in a sense, because he sort of walks in off the street, not really ready for this, not really polished, it's one of the things that actually helps him stand out in this crowd. Does that reflect real life at all? I mean, is it possible for an audition like Nate gives to sort of cut through the crowd?
It really is. I mean, I wrote Better Nate Than Ever for people who are already fans of things like Glee and Smash and Dance Moms, Pitch Perfect. You know, that was all sort of in mind. But I also wanted to tell something maybe a little more realistic about what really happens. I ran a lot of auditions for Billy Elliot, and I also I have auditioned for probably 500 things in my dance career. And the irony about what happens at a children's Broadway audition is that so often the really super polished, over-the-top, glitzy kids get overlooked because it's like it's too much. And it actually can be more attractive to meet a kid who has this like a really natural, honest quality that you can actually coach yourself. And sort of train them into being the Billy Elliot or whichever character, you know, they might someday play. So absolutely, a kid with great heart and soul can always cut through the overly polished kind of stuff. Mm.
Best-selling author Tim Federle. Since this interview aired back in 2013, Tim Federle has gone on to write a number of other books, including several sequels to Better Nate Than Ever, which, by the way, has been adapted for the screen and can be seen on Disney+. Federle is currently the writer and executive producer for Disney's High School Musical, the musical, the series. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my interview with photographer and activist Heidi Wagner. Perhaps you have heard about Heidi Wagner's Passions Project, in Racine. It is about to go on display at the Library of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear a conversation which I recorded with Heidi Wagner earlier this morning, in which Heidi talks about her career as a